dying, Father, is nothing less of since I was a child. I had the feeling that something is missing in me. I want to know why I am here. Can any of us know that?
Become yourself. Then God and the devil don't matter.
I want to learn. I want to understand. Be careful. Can you find the force to enable these two quite opposite lives to live together in yourself? At any moment, the wolf can devour the lamb.
And you must learn what it means to become responsible.
This is an exact life. And that is why you are here.
To the unknown future. This is Renice Radio. For the Seeker.
Tuning in, good day or good evening. Henrik here, thank you for listening. This is Red Ice Radio, and today we are going to do our part two with the writer and former journalist Ole Damgård. He is the author of the book Coup d'etat in slow motion, the assassination of Olof Palme. For those of you with us about a month ago, you know that Ole uncovers the intricate and complicated web of leads that has been created by the International Crime Syndicate in the wake of the assassination of the Swedish Prime Minister some 27 years ago now. So today we're going to proceed to talk about the murder, the people involved, and of course where the trails lead. Well, first of all, welcome back, Ole. Thank you for returning once again. It's good to have you back with us.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Oh, you bet. You know, many of our listeners, of course, were very interested in this program and about the fate, of course, of Olof Palme, the major connections, the first part we did. Was, of course, just kind of an introduction to yourself, to the new book, your overall thoughts and ideas about the work you've been doing, of course. And so in this part two, we are really going to get into some of the details about the event. You've done some extraordinary research and connections all over the place. And we'll in the coming episodes as well, we're going to get into some of these, of course. But we're going to talk more about the manipulated and fabricated evidence protocols and the autopsy report, etc. But why don't we begin to kind of talk about the day again? We want to compare the different versions, if you will, the official versus your version of event. But take us back again to the night of the 28th of February, 1986, Ole. We'll begin there, first of all.
Okay, Friday the 28th this year was quite a cold evening. It was 6 below zero. There was just a little wind. And the Prime Minister, Olof Palme, and his wife, Lisbeth, had decided earlier that day to go to the cinema and see a film called Bröderna Mozart, which was quite a hit film that was quite in at that time. Anyway, it wasn't that usual that they went to things like this, but this evening he had said to his bodyguards that he just wanted to spend time with the family, and so they went to the cinema. What happened then was the official version says that he was observed by the killer, who was later pointed out as a drug addict by the name of Christer Pettersson. That Christer Pettersson had seen them go to the movie and but mistaken them for his drug dealer, Sigge Cedergren. Maybe it's not the police official version, but it's been put forward quite a few times by journalists and other people in official newspapers. Mm. Anyway, so he was waiting. He ran back to his drug dealer's apartment, got a gun, and then waited outside the cinema. And then when Palme came out, because he had the same fur hat this Christer Pettersson is said to have mistaken him for his drug dealer and followed him down the street. And then outside a building, the Skandia building, the insurance company Skandia's building, he went up behind them and fired one shot straight through the body of the prime minister. So he died instantly and fell down on pavement. And then he fired a second shot at his wife, but that missed. And after that, he started running. He went into a passageway and then up some stairs that are today quite famous because of where the sort of the murder escaped. He went up these stairs, and after that, more or less all traces of him has disappeared. This is the official version, and this guy, the Christer Pettersson, was later, he was taken in about 2 years later, in 1988, and accused for this murder. He was pointed out by Lisbeth Palme in a video confrontation where she picked him out among eight other people. And after that, he was sentenced for this crime. He was later pardoned, released, and they said they had made a mistake, so he was released. But in media to this very day, it's all the time that he was the guilty one.
Yeah.
The guilty one, the guilty one, the guilty one. It's again and again and again, and no other investigation has been made more or less into other different possibilities or trails. That is the official version.
That is the official version, and it takes a while, of course, before Christer Pettersson get caught. There are all kinds of strange things that happen, and we're going to obviously get to some of these as well, Ola, but why don't we just kind of run through the second version then and see it from your point of view of many of the inconsistencies and weirdness that happens both before and also on the actual day itself.
Okay, what happened was that right away, like, for instance, like I told you last time, like, if I was standing in central Stockholm tonight and I took a rock and threw in a window, within a minute or two, I would be surrounded by police. There would be people everywhere, witnesses would be taken in who had seen what I'd done, and everything would just be working very smoothly and efficient because Sweden is a very efficient country. But this time, when it came to the assassination of the Swedish Prime Minister, for some reason, absolutely nothing, and I say nothing, worked the way it should. Everything was delayed, everything was messed up, it was just a total disaster. And this has been blamed afterwards as being, well, the Swedish police really messed up, there was technical problems, there was this and that and so on. But when you start looking into what actually happened, what witnesses saw and how they were treated and how evidence was treated, how different documents and autopsy protocols and reports and everything, how you see how this has been manipulated again and again and again and falsified, and how witnesses have been threatened and not been heard, and it's just one awful big mystery that of course has a solution to it if you dig deep enough.
Tell us about the overall environment, I guess we could call it, at the time when Olof Palme was assassinated, because we have two different tracks or tendencies in society at the time. By some, he was seen as a traitor, possibly a double spy. We had the scenario that we have the Soviet bloc on one side of Sweden, and Sweden, again, kind of quote-unquote, are neutral, as we've talked about before, but officially, anyway, they're neutral. And there's a possibility that they might be basically devoured by the Soviet Union. And at the same time, you have NATO, the CIA, and stay-behind armies as well in Sweden since the Second World War. And, of course, they don't want to lose Sweden. At the time, Sweden is a point of shipment, if you will, of weaponry. There are all kinds of dirty deeds going on in Sweden, so it's an important area and an important place for the globalist elite power at the time. So tell us about Olof Palme and how he was seen in many ways as a kind of a double agent or a spy.
That was exactly what you're saying. He was not just any ordinary politician. He was especially on the international scene, he was very active. And he came from a very, very strange background, like we talked about last time, where he came from a very right-wing childhood. And then it was like he was bought almost, or he transferred over to the left side, the social democrat side. And in his early years, he was working for military intelligence, helping to build up the stay behind army in Sweden, together with Bill Colby, who was later the CIA director and so on. So then when he came to become a politician, he was a very controversial, like I said, on the international scene, where he was a member of the Bilderberg Group, which I think most of your listeners know is the very elite group that is part of trying to transform this world into a new world order, a one world fascist state. He was a member of that. And at the same time, he was the politician of the people. He was the defender of the weak. He was the one that opened the doors for refugees. He was the one who took care of the social people who were knocked out of society and so on. So he was a very double person. And I strongly feel that this was an act he was playing, that he was acting for the elite, for the banking elite, for the big business, and at the same time, more or less playing theater for the masses.
Mm. Yeah.
I'm not saying this because I didn't like him or something like that. This has nothing to do with personal like or nothing. It's what the facts are telling me.
Yeah.
And in 1968, he did quite a stunt, because at that time, the United USA was very strong in Vietnam, and they were bombing everywhere and stuff like that. And nobody dared to raise any kind of finger towards America, saying anything critical. And then 1968, Olof Palme, out of nowhere, came and walked in a demonstration together with the ambassador, the Vietnamese ambassador, making a very strong statement against the USA and their involvement in Vietnam. Officially, this really pissed the leadership of USA off. But at the same time, what it did was, because at that time he was a member of the Bilderberg Group and so he was already involved. But what it did was that he became a symbol of the only one who dared to stand up against imperialism and so on. So it opened the doors, like the PLO opened its doors, Cuba opened its door, the Sandinist government opened their doors and welcomed him as a hero.
Yeah.
This was, in my opinion, he was playing a double role here. But people who were not aware of that saw him as a traitor. So we're getting into an area where he was not a traitor for the elements that later saw him as a traitor. Can you follow me?
Yeah, oh sure, absolutely.
So I know when I think it was in 72 after the Hanoi bombings, he went out in TV and said that this is just another name in the list of horrible places, you know, like concentration camps and massacres and stuff like this. This is not just another name on the list of all the horrific things that America has done. Once again, a very, very strong statement to do internationally. And the rest of the world was just like, whoa, whoa, whoa. But he went straight from that TV interview, I've heard from people in the military industrial area, straight back to the banking elite and say, listen, guys, just take it easy. I just had to say these things. Calm down. Nothing is going to change. But I needed to do this.
Yeah.
So we are in an area where officially he's the enemy to the so-called USA. And he's against the Eastern Bloc. He's for these like Cuba and Nicaragua and these countries to help them against the big bad boys. But in real life, it's the exact opposite. When you are a member of the Bilderberg Group, it's not a matter of being a spy or a double spy or a triple spy, because you're above that level, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
That international elite are above the problems with East and West, USA, CIA, KGB. It's beyond that, because it's on that level, it's a theater for the masses. But seen on lower levels, you will be seen as a traitor from different people. And this is what he was seeing. Many people feared that he was a KGB agent. Many people accused him of being hired by the CIA. And he was playing both sides, at least two of the sides, if not more, being in that elite group.
So we have the making of a hero here, a champion of the people, and at the same time working for a completely different, you know, kind of conglomerate force, if you will, in the world entirely. That's your hunch, at least at this point.
It's a very classical trick, you know. Sometimes they do it. If you want to infiltrate a group, you infiltrate with two people, and then you get one of them to find out that the other one is an infiltrator, and expose him. And everybody will go, "Oh my God, he's the bad guy," and the other guy who pointed him out will become the hero.
That's right. Yep.
And from then on, he will be treated differently. We were talking about Yon Gyu in the last program. I think something like that happened, that, you know, very shady things around him. And I think that when he was officially put in jail for a year, I think he went on education, you know, had a one-year education, special training for what was later to come. This is my personal view.
Definitely. Now let's talk a little bit more about how Palme acted in the last few months. Something very strange was going on at the time. He was also going to go off to a meeting in Moscow. And this is when many people feared that, oh my God, Sweden or Scandinavia at large at that point then might basically be devoured by the Soviet bloc. Tell us about this.
Yeah, it's exactly right what you're saying. The last 6 months of his life, more or less 6 months, for some reasons that I will go into in more details in the next program, he suddenly started acting very, very strange. From before, he was always loyal to the elite. He was involved in different major arms deals. He was involved in many of these things that is now being exposed more and more, of illegal activities and stuff like that. But at that point, about 6 months before the assassination, he suddenly started doing totally opposite. He started stopping weapon deals. He started doing things against NATO. He gave up the Swedish right to North Sea oil. He opened up a meeting in Moscow with Gorbachev, which was like unheard of. He wanted. He came forward with a new suggestion for a law that would take away the legal rights of the police if Sweden was invaded. It would take away the rights of the police to act as a police and join the military against the invaders. Instead, they would become like a private unit that would just have to stand under the command of the invaders, and this just shook the whole establishment, you know, especially the right wing elements within the military organizations and the police and so on. They just saw, oh my God, he is such a traitor. So there was a very intense hate around him, and also he was working to get a nuclear-free zone in Scandinavia, and that really threatened the whole submarine, you know, with the submarines have atomic weapons and stuff like that. So that would just stop all the NATO exercises and the Russian submarines and everything in the Baltic Sea in this area, which would make up, it was really mess a whole lot of things up. Also because Sweden is such an important country, strategic-wise, the position where Sweden yes. is very important.
Indeed. But do you think that this was not something that he actually would do, because he was working, as you're implying here, for the big boys, the Bilderberg member, etc.? He would just have this on the proposition so that people would still have the perception that, look, see, he's working for us. He wants to have peace. He wants to do all these good things, right?
Yeah. But it shook, he really made a lot of people very angry with his way of dealing the last few months.
Yeah.
So the investigation, the official investigation, they say that when they met up with the FBI, they said that there was no real motive. There was the situation was totally calm. There was no threats against him. That is absolute not true. The situation was very, very tense when this happened. It was just a month before he was going to go to Moscow, and it was just like, it was boiling under the surface.
So we need to get to, obviously, who at this level decided to take him out then, if he was ultimately working for the big boys. This is a difficult thing. We speculated about this, but I just have one account that I want to mention quickly about the Prime Minister, Olof Palme, when he actually met with Kjell Olof Feldt, he was from the Department of Finance. And this was in 1985. This is actually just about 6 months or so before his assassination. And this is when the Swedish bank system basically was deregulated. And one of the accounts is that when Kjell Olof Feldt brought in to have the meeting with the Prime Minister, Palme, it was like he wasn't there anymore. He was like staring off into the wall. He didn't care. He even said that flat out to him. This is documented on video footage. He said, I don't care anymore. I don't have anything to say in anything anymore. Do what you please. And mind you that this is at a time when they've just recently also had on the proposition that they wanted to nationalize all profits from private companies within Sweden. A complete contradiction to this kind of deregulation that's starting to happen. And of course, later on, this eventually led to the crash of the Swedish krona, the currency and everything else. But this is just another testimony from Kjell Olof Feldt directly that he just basically gave up. He didn't care, it seems like. And I wonder what happened, you know?
This is what we're going to get back to in part three, because this is a totally different area in this assassination, I would say. But just like you say, he became totally uninterested in national politics. You know, he was like Kjell Olof Feldt. He said one time he was explaining a lot of things for Palme, and Palme was just sitting playing a flute behind his desk, you know, totally distracted, didn't listen. He was not there anymore. He didn't care. His mind was somewhere totally different.
There were many secret meetings held, both in Sweden and abroad, extremely concerned about his strange behavior, of course. But tell us about the participants of these meetings and what they were.
There were meetings both in Sweden and abroad. There was quite a few meetings in Sweden. And it was in police station, military, right-wing kind of groupings where, like we said before, he was seen as a real traitor and they just wanted to get rid of him. These forces that attended these meetings were very right-wing, I mean, more or less Nazi elements, but on a very high level. There were, like I said, there were like a series of meetings in Sweden before the assassination. There was also meetings held in Wiltshire in England, where participants from, it was in Wiltshire, and the group that arranged it was called Yggdrasil, which is the name, it's the tree of life, which is very central in Norse cosmology. And this Yggdrasil, this name returns at times also because Olof Palme's name, Palm, was like a tree, and later we're going to come into something that was called Operation Tree that also connected to this assassination. Anyway, this group, they had called together a group from NATO. There were bankers on a very high level. There were people from the military industrial complex. There were politicians. There were the Swedish high commander was there, and so on. And what they wanted also, they were very, very upset about his behavior. And a decision was taken to take him out. But it turns out, in my opinion, that there were actually two operations going on at the same time, both of them with the aim of getting him killed. This is what in the long run makes a real confusion, because two operations going on at the same time, they're just pointing all over the place when you look at the different members. But
I wanted to ask as well, now when you talk about these groups and meetings and stuff, this is not, I guess, then in any kind of quote-unquote official capacity. These are like arms cartel groups and people who are working within, from MI6 to the SAS, the British, military, correct?
Yeah. And one thing I find that I think is very, very important as well is when you look upon assassination or groupings by the elite and so on, you have to see the world from a higher point of view, beyond national borders. It's not a matter of England, USA, Sweden.
Yeah.
These people are using the world as a business. It's like a big franchise. And the military is like used as the enforcer to force the will of this business elite on the world. They're sort of the bullies that will just push forward. So when we talk about the CIA, it's the Central Intelligence Agency, meaning it's an agency you can hire to do the dirty work for you. It's not like the national security for the America. And that's why when you look about these things, you have to look, like I say, from a higher point of view. Otherwise, it doesn't make sense.
Definitely. There is other clues in this as well. The stock market allegedly was kind of preparing, as you said, for the upcoming assassination. What was this about?
You will see that all the bigger assassinations or conspiracies like 9/11, JFK, and Olof Palme as well, you can see how the stock market are being prepared by people, insiders, who know that it's coming. So things are happening slowly and hidden because they know the impact of a hit like that, what that would be, the reaction in the world. So what they do is, it's very often that these things happen on a Friday, because then they can, when the shots are fired, boom, they right away they close the stock market, and then they have until Monday to sort everything out, because the stock market is closed because of mourning, because they're so sad.
Yeah.
But that gives them this time to fix everything. And then when the stock market opens, they lock the currencies while it's happening. And then when it opens up again, they have made absolute fortunes. And like in any murder case, they say follow the money when you go for motives. And the guy who made the most, at least official money, was the businessman Erik Penser, mm-hmm. Erik Penser, who his company, who happened to be named Yggdrasil, here we go again.
Interesting.
He's very, very involved in the military complex with Bofors and other stuff like that. And he made I can't remember how much it was, 1.2 billion Swedish krona or something like that, overnight because of that, or during the weeks around the assassination.
That's right. And he... I think he actually ended up losing a lot of it. Actually, later, consequently, in the crash of the Swedish currency, as I mentioned before. But nonetheless, he made shitloads of money when this actually happened. And again, it doesn't mean, of course, that he's behind it alone. This means basically that he was in on it with the other group of people that we're going to talk more about here later today. Of those who are in the know, and then also financially can gain on it. Politically, people gain on it. There's so many agendas that are fulfilled, if you will, at the same time when this happens.
When you look into conspiracies like this, it gets extremely complicated. Extremely complicated. It's not easy to explain in an easy way. So I hope we can do a good job of just trying to sort the things out. one by one.
We'll try to get to all your points and all your thoughts, Ulla, and spend some time at it, because it's really incredible when you go into it, and there is such a mass of information from different kinds of points of view, and so it's difficult to know to even where to begin to unravel this beast, if you will. But let's just proceed here and do the best we can. It was winter holidays at the time. Tell us about that.
No, if you the way I've gotten as wide a picture as I have from this is by studying many of the other big conspiracies, like JFK, I spent many, many years looking into that, like the Robert Kennedy assassination, like Martin Luther King, like 9/11 and so on. And once you do that, when you do that, you start after a while, you can see get a very clear picture of how these things are done, how they prepare them, how they carry them out, and so on. And then it is in this way that then when something new happens, that you will be able to foresee or even, get a much sharper picture out of it, because it's the same pattern being repeated again and again. So with the other big conspiracies, what happens is that the group behind them, the order for the hit comes from a very, very high point. It goes down through the pyramids of power where it gets diffused, so you have no idea, you can't track it backwards where it came from. But it comes down to the street level, sort of where the actual hit team is put together. The hit team who is going to do it have absolutely no idea who hired them. They have no idea why they're doing it. They're just being hired as good, skilled professionals. And these groups, the hit team, are most of the time put together by very, very top assassins from different countries, different groups, without any obvious connections.
And we want to name some of these later, by the way.
Yeah,
we're gonna
of
get
course.
Into this. Yeah.
But they're also being put together in small groups of 2-3 people at a time, connected with the radio. The whole point is to keep it at what they call a need-to-know chain, so that no one who's involved should know the whole picture. They should only know their little part. Only a very few people at the top will know the whole picture, what's going on. So often these people who are involved, they don't even know who the real victim is until it's over, or they didn't really know why they were positioned why they had to stand there or there, and until afterwards. And afterwards, once it happened, they couldn't come forward, because then they would point themselves out as being guilty, being part of it.
The timing, there is basically the government is not in place. You mentioned the king is not there due to winter holidays, right?
Exactly. This is also, if you look at the other big assassins, like for instance with the Kennedy assassination, like they see to it that the government, or the government, the people that know about it, everybody is away. It's plausible denial that nobody should be able to point them. So everybody's out of the way. This was the winter holiday, so it's the perfect day to do it. The king is out of town. And most people in Stockholm are on winter holidays as well. So the city is more or less dead. And this Friday evening was no exception. It was very dead. There was very few people in the streets. Like I say, it was 20 past 11 in the evening. So there were no problems with a lot of witnesses that would interfere.
Yeah.
There have been between 50 and 200 observations of people with walkie-talkies, depending on what sources you listen to.
Wow.
None of these have been accepted by the official investigation. There's also quite a few people have been pointed out being part of this assassination. None of them have been heard. And if they've been heard by the investigation, it's been after a lot of pressure from press and stuff like that. They've been very reluctant to even take a step forward to do that. Totally the opposite. As if they had really been interested in finding the truth. And if you look at other biggest conspiracies, you will also see that that the people who are doing the assassination itself have created an investigation, their own investigation that is on standby. They get the hit team, they have their own investigation on standby, and they have a prepared patsy, the guy they're going to blame everything on.
Yeah.
And they have evidence that has been put together that would point to that one. So the instant when they make sure that there are no bodyguards, they take away all kind of security around the victim.
Did he have it anyway, Olof Palme? Did he usually have bodyguards?
No, he had bodyguards, but rarely. He didn't officially like them. And Sweden at that time was such a peaceful country. There was no violence, no murders. Sweden was really proud that the prime minister could take his bicycle to work and so on.
Right.
But this day he had said officially, this is what it said, that he told his bodyguards that you can take the day off. I want to spend the evening with my wife.
So there is preparations in place at the time, is to say that the patsy is already there, kind of decided upon, everything, etc. But there are other bigger things as well. The helicopter division is on standby.
The official version, as I said before, is that it was one lone crazy guy, which is standard. I can just say, anytime you hear about a lone crazy guy who did it, wake up, look into what's going on. It doesn't matter if it's a hit in Venezuela or Mexico or wherever. If it's a lone crazy guy, it's time to look into it. Because the reason why they pick a lone crazy guy is because he was crazy. He just shot him. There was no reason. There's no explanation. Just let it get over with. And very often this guy dies in a violent way. So everything is sorted and case closed. Thank you very much. Let's move on. If we look at this evening when he was shot, like I said, if it had been a normal case, what would have happened if somebody had fired a shot in central Stockholm like that? Within a few minutes, the center of Stockholm would have been cut off with police cars and not SWAT teams, but almost like there would be a whole lot of activity
right away.
Commotion going on. The prime minister had been shot down the airports, shut down ferry lines. Everybody called in the National Guard, like that. What happened this evening? Absolutely zero. Nothing. Instead, when people came forward, witnesses came forward and said, yeah, I saw him run that way. I saw this, I saw that. The police who came to the site, they said, well, thank you so much, but we already have a witness, so we don't need you. Or they said, one woman said, I saw one of them with blonde. He was running down the street here. They said, thank you, we're not looking for blonde guys. Another said he was running after the killer, and a police car came, who was officially hunting the killer, came and passed him. He was running exactly where after the assassin, and the police car just passed him without stopping him. They looked at him and they just passed him. And also what happened was that when people called in right when it happened and said somebody had been shot, nobody knew it was Olof Palme at that time, but the guy who sat in the alarm central delayed the calls. An alarm was sent out, an alert was sent out after a little while, but only to a very few hand-picked police vans that came to the site. They were the first at the assassination site after the police chief Gösta Söderström, who was the first guy who was outside the assassination, the conspiracy type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But the people who came to the assassination site and started hunting the killer was all of the people in central position this evening belonged to a very small group, a very, very small group of right-wing extremist policemen in Stockholm. I have to rewind a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
When you look at the bigger conspiracies again, when you have one team that goes in, they come from abroad, whatever country it is, doesn't matter, but they take people from abroad because they are harder to track. They will do the surveillance of the victim, okay? Then when it gets closer, when they pinpointed all the important details around where and how and when, this surveillance team has also been supplied with weapons and housing and vehicles and all of this thing by local people on that side. These people are almost always right-wing, military people, security, that type of prison wardens, these type of people, very disciplined and violent people. So you have the surveillance team, and you get the weapons and all the logistics sorted by people, local people. And then when it's time, you bring in the real hit team from abroad. The surveillance team stands back and watch when the hit is done. Then they come in again and see to that the hit team is helped out. You also got a backup team that will help the hit team to get rid of the weapons, the clothes, evidence, all of this thing. At the same time, you have another team that often they come dressed as police officers or in uniforms, and they clear the crime scene of any type of evidence that can point towards the actual assassins.
Mm.
You also have, like I said before, you have your own investigation.
You control the whole thing from the start to the finish. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Because the last thing you want is honest, decent, normal policemen who are used to investigate these type of things who will mess it up. So these people are pushed aside, and in comes your investigation. They take over everything, and from that day, their job is to point. They went that away. They went that away. They went that anything except pointing inwards towards the truth.
Yeah.
This is exactly what you see happen in Stockholm. This is exactly what happened with the Kennedy assassination, where the Warren Commission, where Oswald, all of these things were put together. You saw it with Robert Kennedy as well, that's the way it's carried out. You can see it on an international level, because there's so many of these assassinations that have been done over the years by a very small group of people. And very often it's the same assassins as well. They use, when it comes to a job on a high level, they use the best. So you will see that these people who are in this group will see the identities pop up again and again and again in different constellations.
I'm going to bookmark that one, Ola, because we need to return to that. You shared with me before we began the recording some very, very interesting names and similarities as well here. So let's return to that. But again, let's just talk about the movie theater scenario a little bit here. The fact that this is a perfect place to do it, because you have an hour or more or so of preparation. You know where he's going to be. You know where he's going to walk out, etc. What do you think about the movie theater thing? How soon could they have known about that? Was that arranged in any other capacity so they knew where he was going to be?
No, it was the perfect, absolute perfect place. He was held under surveillance for at least 5-6 weeks before. Witnesses have seen walkie-talkie men outside his house. They've been observed in different places around where he was moving around. So when you look at it, where would be a good place to hit? It could be around his home, it could be around the parliament, or it could be around the Social Democrat headquarters. Yeah, these are some of the standard places that he would go. And this cinema was right opposite the Social Democrats headquarters, right opposite that. So it was the perfect spot, because they had it had been checked out for a long time before. Also, his phone was tapped, and so when they heard that he was going to go that afternoon, at the same time, if now I would go into the picture of saying, when you start putting the pieces together, okay, seeing what happened that day. So when Palmer had mentioned to his wife and son that they were going to go to the cinema that evening, there was a program on a local radio station. It was a theater play where a right extremist group said that a statesman is going to be killed. It's not going to be a Swedish statesman is going to be killed, and it's not going to be Gustav III, which was the last big assassination in Sweden. They said that this traitor has been sitting at, on the throne for too long, spreading lies everywhere. It has to stop. And then they all laugh and stuff like that. It may sound quite innocent, that thing, but I'm going to come back afterwards to who were the members of this so-called culture group that had made this radio show. And if I'm right, that theater on this local radio station was the start sign that the different groupings who was involved was waiting for.
Really?
That was the signal. That was the signal saying, "Okay, we're on."
Interesting.
Because after that, you suddenly see that there's a movement. You see different police cars are moving into place. You see different groupings are moving into central Stockholm.
And this is based on eyewitness testimony at the time, correct?
Yeah, yeah. Everything I say is what people have seen or heard. If it's my theory, I will tell you.
Okay. Good, good.
So. It's my theory that this is the start point, that this is the go-ahead point. But that is the, after that, you can see people moving into position and so on.
So they do it right in the open, announcing it on the media, even smarter, I guess, to a certain degree.
Yeah, but it was just that there was somebody, an old lady, listened to it and thought, my God, this is really odd. So she called in and told the police about it. That's the only reason why I know about it.
Interesting.
Him going to the cinema is the absolute perfect scenario because it's in a place that they know well, and also they know once he gets into the cinema, they will have him there for at least an hour and a half, so they can move everything into place around it. And so when they come to the cinema, when they leave their house, witnesses are observed that the two walkie-talkie men follow them, or two men follow them. Some see a walkie-talkie, but they see these two men following. I can describe them later on. Anyway, so they follow them on the subway. They come into central Stockholm, and they go to the cinema. Once they're in the cinema, witnesses see that there's one person outside the entrance. He's just standing, looking really weird, with a starry eyes and looking very hostile. That guy, the description of him differs, but that's because he was another one. He was relieved after a while. You know, somebody else took his place.
Mm-hmm.
But they put him there to make sure that the prime minister would not go anywhere, okay? So while he was there, there were three escape cars put into action. There was a white Volvo 242 GL, there was a red Ford Escort, and there was a light blue Volkswagen Passat. I don't know what that is in English. Passat. Anyway, these three cars are moving around in the center, and you have people are starting observing all of these people with walkie-talkies. In those days, people didn't use mobile phones, so it was very obvious what they were doing. And it was not small walkie-talkies either. Some of them were quite big, almost like military type of thing.
Right.
But they were moving very openly. They were not hiding in any way. And this is, once again, because the people know that they were going to be helped to get away. They know that they don't fear retaliation. You know, if it had been you and me, we would have been sneaking around whispering. These people were standing right in the open, speaking loud, and also these people were quite proud of being part of this thing, because in their opinion, they were getting rid of an awful person.
Sure,
you know?
Sure. Now you also speculate that the operation is directed from Scandia Bar, right? The bar in Scandia Hotel, correct?
No.
Okay, no. What is that then?
It's okay. The site where he was later shot. I'll rewind. I'll go back to the cinema. Okay.
Okay.
When they came out from the cinema, they went out, and Olof Palme and his wife and son and his girlfriend, they stood talking just for a few minutes outside. And at that time, there was a walkie-talkie man on the other side of the street. There was also people down Sveavägen, like 100 meters down Sveavägen, on both sides, they were waiting. And on parallel streets, on both sides, you had people being observed with walkie-talkies and with police cars driving slowly up and down. Police cars, some of them that was not officially on duty, okay? Mm. And there was one, what do you call it, like a police chief car. It was called 1520. It was a commissionary car, police chief. Anyway, the people that saw that car saw that the back seat was filled with technical equipment. There was flashing lights and antennas and stuff like that. And it has later been put forward that this car was there to amplify the signal between the walkie-talkies and the commando central that was organizing the whole thing.
Okay.
Okay. Then you had two policemen, 3230, which was filled with right-wing policemen. And another one called 1230. They were also standby. They were on both sides on the parallel streets of Sveavägen. So when the Palme's son and girlfriends, they say that we're going to go home and have a cup of tea, and Olof Palme and his wife decides to walk home instead of taking the subway. So they start walking down south of Sveavägen, and witnesses observe one guy following them. I mean, people recognized Palme, so they thought he was a bodyguard. He was following like 15, 20 meters behind them.
Mm-hmm.
And while they were walking down the street, on the parallel streets, there were another witness who saw three men coming running very, very fast down the parallel street to get in position. Further down the street, on both sides, there were people observed. Some of them saw one man standing just outside where he was later shot, and they thought that he was a criminal that was waiting to do some kind of a drug a deal or something like that, because he looked a bit strange.
Okay.
Anyway, so they walked down the street, and when they walked down the street, these different cars and people on both sides of the street are following them. There's also walkie-talkie men a little further down outside Adolf Fredriks Kyrkogata. There's one guy there with a walkie-talkie. And other people are also observing 50 meters further down the road, another guy with a walkie-talkie who's speaking very high, loud in a walkie-talkie,
sure,
in a strange language. They say it sounded like Swiss German kind of thing. When he finally comes down, they go down the street, and then they decide to cross the street because officially Lisbeth wanted to see, there was a shop for women's clothes, so she wanted to have a look there. So they go there on the other side of the street, and then from there they start walking down towards where he's going to be assassinated. And the official story says that they walked there, and when they came to the corner, that one of these guys was standing around the corner. It's sort of like a bit of a strange corner, a cut-off corner. He was standing there in the shadows waiting. And then when they passed him, he just walked up behind him and fired one shot right in the back of Olof Palme, another one at Lisbeth, then took left and ran about 100 meters before he went up the stairs and then to the next level. It's about, I think, 30 meters up. And there he just disappeared after some witnesses had seen him there up there. And from then on, officially no one has ever seen him after that.
Hmm. Okay.
If we reverse a bit and we see the people that have been observed that evening there, we will see that there's a small group of Swedish policemen that are connected with right-wing military people.
And let's bring in some names here at this point as well, then. Who are we talking about here?
Yeah, who are connected with this Stay Behind movement. I think your listeners know about Stay Behind, do they?
Yeah, we've talked about it in the past. For those who don't know, of course, these are the NATO forces that were here after the World War after World War II, and basically they're staying behind enemy lines at that stage and setting up the intelligence operative networks on the European side.
What it is like a ghost army that has built up built up in all the different NATO countries. It was sort of one of the requirements to be able to enter NATO was that they would take part of this as well. Mm. But since Sweden was not part of NATO, they went in secretly and built this secret ghost army inside Sweden with the help of people, among them Torge Erlander and Olof Palme. And this ghost army consists, and to this day, I still think it's around. It goes under many different names. All the different countries have their own names of it. It's called Gladio, Stay Behind, Rear Guard in Sweden, Aktionsgrupp, Arla Gryning. There are many different names of different groupings inside the same. So just to make it easy, we're going to call them Stay Behind.
Yeah.
And Stay Behind consisted of small groups, often like eight people, or military people, one radio operator, one commander, five, six soldiers. They had arms depots dug down in the ground. They had fuel, all of these things, so that there was a whole network hidden on standby should the country be invaded. So that, let's say that Russia invaded Sweden, with no preparation at all, there would already be a defense force ready, mm-hmm. like a guerrilla army ready to fight them.
Yeah.
And this was built up from, with the help of the CIA, the director later, William Colby, in Sweden here. He worked through the American embassy. And they built this up in Sweden from, I think, 54 and onwards.
Yeah.
Anyway, their headquarters was in the building of this insurance company, Skandia, exactly at the spot where he was killed. I mean, we're not talking about 100 meters. We're talking like there, 2 meters away from. The headquarters, at the time of the murder, they had moved it, but that was where Olof Palme had been part of many of these meetings. With the Stay Behind. Hmm. The problem with Stay Behind was the idea was great that it was to defend a country like that. But instead, after a while, CIA started using it as a strategy in their strategy of tension, as a force to inflict violence on a society for people, the population, to ask for more and more protection. So by scaring people, people will accept more and more control.
That's right.
So Stay Behind is involved in, if not all, then so many of the so-called terror attacks in Europe and in many other countries.
Yeah, all these false flag attacks, and they have to do it on themselves. They have to be the ones who are instigating the terror because no one out there is doing it, so they have to do it.
It's like after all of these years, I don't even know if there is such a thing as a terrorist, because every time there is a thing like whatever it is, when you start looking into it, you it's the same thing again and again and again. Mm. It's like, and with these school shootings and all of the, you start looking into it, it's the same story again and again and again.
Right.
And like we talked about before, that they use what is called a three-step rocket. You create a problem in a secretly you created to get a reaction from people, from the population, so that you can come with your solution. Very often this problem is a bomb or bomb. They love bombs. And so in the media, they prepare some kind of scapegoat. I think maybe it's bird lovers next time, or crocodile hunters, or whatever.
Sure, I remember that.
Whatever weird thing they come up with,
yep.
Maybe the Green Parrot Bird Foundation or something like that. And in the media, they will start pumping out saying that this group, they have secret meetings and they have planned to do whatever.
Now, Ulo, sorry to cut you off, but let's advance forward a little bit here. I do want to get into some of the names and some of the things that happened. There's a diversion fire started in Nacka industrial area at the time. Also another calling card that they're trying to divert attention, obviously. What do you know about that?
Exactly like you say, once they started, when around the time of the assassination, a lot of things went on, not only in Stockholm. Like there were a helicopter division that was on standby. I'm sure there was a lot of other places the military was on standby as well that I don't know of. But to avoid riots or to be able to control the country, they did the same with at the Kennedy assassination. There was a whole, I don't know how many planes were up in the air flying around the states, just, you know, checking if everything was okay, any riot alert, so that you could very fast go in and just stop it. Same here, black helicopters that was in the air waiting, and where stay behind was on standby as well. And also one way of getting rid of the no-see journalists and photographers is to divert them. So there was this fire started out in the Nacka industrial area, and that just meant the few police or journalists that was there that night went out there to check that out, which was it's a good idea. I mean, if you know how it's done, get rid of them.
Sure,
and definitely. That's what they did.
So more things alluding to the fact that these are planned. There's another very interesting idea here as well on top of it, which is the patsy that was placed out, the crazy Austrian, right, has been prepared, if you will, to be the patsy. But tell us, and he was, basically to be picked up then just minutes after the shooting, but tell us who this guy is. Wilhelm Kramm is his name.
Yeah, the guy that they had prepared as a patsy was called, his name was Wilhelm Kramm, and he was called the crazy Austrian. And in the hours, actually just after this theater play was played on the local radio, the chief of police, who was later, he had never led a murder investigation before, but the police chief that was put to lead this whole murder investigation around the Palmer murder, he came into his own office. Officially, he was up skiing in the north of Sweden, but he was there that afternoon. And he went in and just said, well, by the way, this crazy Austrian has just threatened both myself and Olof Palme. He says he's going to kill us both and so on. So his colleagues, they say, but my God, should we do something? Should we tell Palme or something? He said, no, don't worry about that. No problem. And then he left. Okay. So a few hours later, when the actual plan took place, this guy was supposed to be picked up and then pointed out as the patsy. But at the exact time of the shooting, this guy was accidentally stopped by another police car that was not involved in the assassination and just questioned for something else. Anyway, 10 minutes later, exactly where the shooter was picked up, just minutes after the shooting, picked up by one of the escape cars, the light blue Volkswagen Passat, and taken off. Just a minute after he left, somebody dropped him off, this crazy guy, Wilhelm Kramm, in the exact same spot so that he could be picked up by the police. And he was taken in for interrogation. And the police chief said, when he went home 7 o'clock that morning, he said that, I thought the case was shot and, you know, everything was okay. This Wilhelm Kramm was actually a guy that turned up years later in the press. His real name is Josef Fritzl. And he's the guy that was called the cellar monster. He was the guy who held his own daughter for 24 years captive in the basement of the villa in Austria. Jeez. Where he made her pregnant with, I think, 7 kids or something like that. Totally crazy.
Wow.
And now he's been put away for life. This guy is connected. He was according to inside information, I've been told that he was supplying the Mossad and CIA with false passports and stuff like that. And they were aware of this thing with his daughter, so they could blackmail him into keeping quiet. And maybe that was also what they would have used against him had he been the patsy, that he would never have said anything because he knew that they could, reveal. Yeah.
So this guy who was in the news, just a few years ago now, I guess it was, at the time, basically, he was up in Stockholm at the time. He was flown there. He was obviously used in this whole thing as to be set up as a patsy. He might, even then at that time, my math is not on top of it right now, 24 years, he might have actually at that time had his daughter locked away in the cellar already at that point when he was up in Sweden.
Yeah, for sure.
Isn't that crazy? Jeez.
Yeah. But and that was the thing, they had him by the balls.
Yeah. But he was do you know what happened to him? Was he just flown out and left the country because he didn't work out as a patsy, obviously?
I don't know what happened to him afterwards. I don't know. Then I found out this connection later on, but I have no idea.
Very interesting.
But we need to go back to the crime scene, because there's a very central group. The Swedish part of this group, it's a right-wing police, a group of right-wing policemen. They went under the name of the Baseball League. It was a group of very violent policemen in Stockholm, in central Stockholm, at the Norrmalms police station. And that police district is the one that involves all the major buildings, like the Royal Castle, like the Parliament, all of these things. This group, the Baseball League, was actually started by the guy who was later to lead the whole murder investigation. His name was Hans Holmér, and he was the former chief of Säpo, which is the Swedish security police. But at the time of the murder, he was the Lens Polismästare, which was sort of the police chief for Stockholm. And this guy had absolutely no experience with murder investigation, nothing like that. But he had very, very strong connections into Stay Behind and to these right-wing elements. Hmm. Anyway, this evening, this group of policemen, it's only a group of like around 10 people, but they move into all the key positions around this assassination. There's one guy who that exact evening takes over in the communication central. He's the one where when people calls in and say there's been a shooting here, and he's the one who delays. His name is Ulf Hedin. Okay, then you have the policeman, the one that came first to the murder site after the police commissioner, Gösta Söderström. That whole van is filled with people from this baseball gang. And they were the ones who ran after the assassin after they had been ordered. Witnesses says they were sort of laughing around, playing around. The witnesses couldn't understand. They said, like, come on, go.
Yeah.
And then they ran after the assassin, but very like one of them took the,
escalator up the...
He took the escalator up. He was a little overweight. He took the escalator up. But if you think of it, if you're chasing an armed assassin, would you really stand in an escalator where there's no hiding, where it's so easy to get a shot at you? At least I wouldn't do it. I would really sort of be very aware. Anyway, they chase him, apparently, and they go up the stairs and they more or less stop there. On top of the stairs, they wait, and then this 1520, the police chief's car, comes the guy, the car that has just passed the guy that ran after the assassin, and without stopping him, which was very strange, because if they had officially They say that when they heard the alert, they went. They wanted to go in the back streets just to see if they could cut off a possible escape route. But if that would be the truth, why didn't they stop this guy that they saw coming running?
Yeah,
there was no description of the assassin or anything like that. So if that had been true, they would have stopped this guy. But instead, this guy that chased the shooter, he had to stop and run back after the police car and saying, listen, I saw him. And what did they do? Did they take him in the car, turn it around and go the way he said the shooter went? No. They said, you stay here with one of these guys. So he stood waiting there for some minutes. And then he was brought back down to the site of the assassination where he was questioned. I don't even know if he was questioned that evening.
Yeah, isn't that amazing? There are so many delays, so many things that just doesn't follow regular procedure, you know?
You also have a major problem here because the policemen, these two cars, the van that came and the car that came on top of the stairs that up there, both of these cars are there about 6 minutes too early because the alert had not gone out at that time.
Yeah.
You see, yeah. We have a problem here. And the police chief, Gösta Söderström, who was the one guy who came first, he was alerted by a guy in the street saying there's been a shooting up on Sveavägen. So he came with his driver. At that time, they had no idea that it was the prime minister that had been shot. So in all these situations, it's standard to write down the time of when they were alerted and when they came to the site. So he just did that, standard. You know, he wrote down the time. He came there and... While he was there, there were some witnesses trying to, people around that was trying to help Olof Palme, and his wife was running around screaming, "They've shot my husband!" And then the other policeman came, and these guys just went out, and Gösta Söderström said, "Go after the killer!" You know, no, we don't have. Protective armor, you know, no, maybe we should wait and stuff like that. He said, you're going, just get going. Mm. And so they started running after him, but in a very, not very serious way. Mm. Also, there's another one, the ambulance that was supposed to come that evening to pick him up. That evening, a woman, Maria Degerman, from the same police station, was the driver.
Mm.
She had that evening, and the driver of the police car 1520, you know, the one that passed the guy, he belonged to the same baseball league, and his name was Thomas Ekesäter, and the police commissioner Christian Dalsgaard was known to be in right wing, situation.
Sure, yeah.
So there's there's one walkie-talkie man who was standing outside Olof Fredriks kyrka. He was identified by witnesses as Thomas Pilz, another member of this baseball gang. And the guy that was standing outside the cinema, he was identified to, his name was Leif Tell. He was also a member of the baseball gang. You see, there's a lot of things here. If you only got a group of 10 people, a lot of them are here. They pop up all around this place, I would say. And also, when the alert was sent out by the guy in the commando center, who was one of the guys, it only went to a few special cars. No one in the central Stockholm, no one of the normal police had any idea what had happened. There were no alerts going out, nothing. And the national alert, the first national alert, went out almost 3 hours later.
That's right.
At 2:06 in the morning. And at that point, they said it was two shooters. Lisbeth, the wife of Olof Palme, hadn't seen any, she didn't see any face or anything like that of the guy. Also, she described, and the witnesses also described, that when he ran very fast and he looked a bit like a bodybuilder. You know, his head was a bit small for the rest of his body. And he ran with very powerful steps.
Mm.
Later years, when they brought in the patsy Christer Pettersson, everything was changed. And then suddenly he ran like a lame elephant. You know, and it was like all it just changed.
the malnourished, you know, drug dude. He can't run that well at that point. So yeah, that's true.
This thing with the cars being there 6 minutes too early really messed things up for the conspirators, because suddenly they couldn't. How could they have known about the alert before it went out? How could they come to the motorcycle before they were alerted?
Mm.
You know.
Yeah.
So after that, someone has tried very hard to manipulate a lot of the evidence. So, for instance, like the list, the time list, and the radio communication things. There's a lot there. If you really look into it, you will find a lot of things that is not correct.
There is a lot. Yeah.
Can you blame this on an alcoholic crazy guy? No. You have to look in who can manipulate things like this. You have to go into the police. You have to go into who can allow it from the higher levels, not investigating these things. Then you come higher up.
And I want to say
and
as well.
Higher up and higher up.
Definitely, and I want to say as well that the reason then that this is, you know, more or less agreed upon within this group, they probably at that stage even managed to convince more and more people that they talk to because of the way that they overall think about, you know, Palme at the time. This seems as the most reasonable thing to do because, as you said before, he's seen as a traitor. You know, whole country might be given up to the Soviet bloc. All the private companies are going to have all of their profits being nationalized and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. I mean, these are big things for these you know, financiers and for, you know, people involved in the companies and those who are kind of already at an international national stage at this point. So this is just what they probably agreed upon, and it's in their view the only viable solution, at least in the beginning, to kind of get out of this, you know, weird place that Swedish politics have ended up in. And they see Olof Palme as the symbol for everything that's gone wrong in the country, I think. You know what we're going to do? We're gonna take a short break. We've kind of gone over the time a little bit for the first hour, but that's okay. There's a lot to get to, a lot to discuss. And we're going to carry on, of course, talk more about the names. We're going to get into the JFK connection and much more in the second. But before we just wrap things up here, please give us out your website again and mention your book as well, Ulla.
My website is www.murderofpalme.com. And my book is called Statskupp in Slow Motion, or in English, Coup d'etat in Slow Motion. And it's on my website. You can download it for free or by donation. I'm very, very grateful for any donations, because I've spent, I don't know how many years, but almost 15 years of very hard work with big risk for myself trying to find out what actually happened here.
Indeed, very much so. We're going to carry on and talk more about this in the second, Anula. So do stay with us. We'll be back with more.
Stir it up, come on, baby.
In the next hour, Ulla will continue to detail the people from the Baseball League, the members from the Swedish police basically facilitating the international crime network in place in Stockholm at the time, making sure that the operation ran smoothly. Ulla will talk about those who took part of the actual murder more directly as well. We'll run through that list. We'll discuss what he calls the Super Death Squad. This is people from the notorious Operation 40, the CIA-sponsored undercover operation, and how many of these people shows up as well in the connection to the JFK assassination. We also talk about the Lockerbie bombings, the Iran-Contra affair, the assassination of John Lennon, and he speculates that Bob Marley also was assassinated, and ties it into this bigger picture. There's also the so-called South African connection with the ANC and the super spy Craig Williamson, who shows up in so many other international bombings, burglaries, kidnappings, assassinations, and propaganda all during the apartheid era. Please check out our members' website, redicemembers.com. If you don't have a membership already, sign up for a subscription to listen to our continuation and all our previous programs. redicemembers.com has all that info for you. We have some great shows coming up with Kurt Lindahl, John Cale, and David Truman. It's a roundtable on geomancy. We have Randall Carlson on sacred geometry and cosmic patterns. We're going to get an update from Richard Hoagland. Later, we have Michael Hoffman on revisionist history. Also, True Art on the subversion of Western culture. Then we have Stephen Miller and Dan Johnson from Panda. That's the People Against the NDAA. Later, we have Josh Reeves on the lost secrets of ancient America. Greg Braden and Bill Donahue, but right now we will proceed with the second hour with Ulla Dammegård. Thank you for staying with us.